Hey, everyone. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, the number one female-focused food podcast in the universe. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, coming to you from Brooklyn, New York. Today is Juneteenth, a holiday that marks the end of slavery in America, which is why it's been referred to as the True Independence Day. I hope all of you are able to honor the day in your own way and reflect on what it represents. I'm so glad you're tuning in because today's episode is incredibly special. I know I say that every week, but this week really is. It's with Paola Velez, a pastry chef based in Washington, D.C., and the co-founder of Bakers Against Racism. The initiative started as a simple call to unite bakers in the fight against the unjust treatment of Black people in the United States. Paola and her co-founders were hoping 80 or so people would join in their bake sale. Instead, they sparked a global movement. Bakers Against Racism has ignited solidarity on 5 continents, in 17 countries, and in 41 states. Until coronavirus devastated the restaurant industry, Paola was the pastry chef at the critically acclaimed Afro-Caribbean restaurant, Kith and Kin. She is creative, charismatic, honest, and a force to be reckoned with. The industry is lucky to have Paola in it. I'm honored to bring you this conversation. So, Paola, we're going to start at the beginning. Tell me where you spent your childhood.
So I grew up in the Bronx in New York City. And every summer for 3-4 months, depending on how my mom felt, I would go to the Dominican Republic and live there. She thought it was really important to make sure that I split my difference so that I knew my heritage, but also, you know, experience the American way of life.
And did you stay with family members in the Dominican Republic?
Yeah, before everything happened, like with my grandmother passing away and my grandfather passing away, we would just stay at our family home in the, what we call it is El Campo. And it just means it means camp, literally translated, but it just means like the countryside. That's where I kind of like learned how to appreciate food and how to grow my own veg and herbs and, you know, appreciate like fresh fruits. You see a lot of that in my desserts now.
I'm so sorry you lost your grandparents. When did they pass away?
I was young. I was fairly young, you know, maybe 10.
Oh, that must have been so hard.
Yeah, it was difficult, you know, but my grandmother really, with the time that we did have, she impacted my life and changed everything that I thought about, you know, where before I might have not appreciated food because when you think about American culture, you think about fast. She kind of like helped me like slow down at a very young age and really look and see and appreciate what the earth gives us and how the world nourishes us. From a very, very young age, I understood the complexities of food and how we hold our heritage through it.
Can you tell us some of the things that she both cooked and grew?
She would cook a big meal, which consists of rice, beans, chickens that we would grow, herd. It was very traumatic at first because they were my pets. And then I realized very quickly the food system. I was like, oh, you know, she would make this huge meal and she would invite everybody in the neighborhood, everyone that was able to come. It didn't matter if you were rich, poor. It didn't matter if you were young or old, and we would all kind of sit in the front yard and in the backyard and eat from my grandmother's food. And she had that meal and a cup of coffee ready in the middle of the day for everybody, always. It didn't matter what was going on in our lives, she had that ready. And that's something that we, as a family, now when we go to the Dominican Republic, we continue as a tradition. So everybody knows our family to be hosts. So it's very fitting that now I work in the hospitality industry.
Did your grandmother have a specialty?
Yes. So she would make coconut rice with peas. So moro de arroz con guandule, con coco. And it was cooked in the wood fire. We had like a house that was open air, that they had bricks that you put your wood fire in. And that's how she would cook. Everything was cooked by sobre leña, which means over fire. Well, all of my experience in the Dominican Republic, I didn't know what a stove was in the Dominican Republic. My brain never made that connection that you could have like a gas stove because we always use wood fire. So
how about some of the things that she would grow? You mentioned fruits, you mentioned herbs. What were some of the things in her garden?
Her garden consisted of this plot of land in front of our house and behind our house, and we call it El Cacao. And El Cacao means the cacao trees. And it was just rows and rows and rows and rows of wild cacao that grew naturally in our backyard. Laced in between were mango trees, tamarind, avocado, plantains, right next to our house. And our well of rainwater was guava and passion fruit, which I always like to say, whatever fruits like to grow together will always taste good together. We had herbs in the back in the shaded area where it was anything that you can think of, achote, cilantro, oregano, culantro, and more. For me, we had lemongrass growing by the side of the house, and I would drink that tea and it would be a natural mosquito repellent. So it's pretty nice, you know?
Oh my gosh. I'm starting to get the impression that it's no surprise you became a chef.
I think so. I mean, it was a good fit. I feel like I was the only one in my family that kind of took that same sentiment of food and being connected with nature like that, like my grandmother did, and turned it into a way to give back to the community. So I've always been using food as a way to connect with other people because I'm very shy. I don't make like a great first impression. It's very awkward at first. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry you had to go through that with me, you know. But with food, I can show you who I am without having to kind of like pretend. I can just show you my history.
It's one of your languages in a sense.
Yeah. I guess it is my love language. I kind of overfeed people all the time. I'm like, eat, because you deserve to eat, you know?
At what point, Paola, did you decide that this could be a profession?
I had graduated high school early. Well, I had enough credits to graduate early, but I didn't graduate early because I wanted to stay with my friends. I was now looking back, I understand that that was a lot of my anxiety and my fear of the unknown. So I stayed in something that I understood, in the familiar. But I had a year to kind of figure it out, and I didn't. And I finally was like, oh, maybe I can do art. Maybe I can go to art school. And then I was like, oh, if I become an artist, then I have to make art and then kind of like die to be recognized, you know, because that's like all how all like really good artists get recognized. It's like they're like, oh no, they're gone too soon. And I was like, oh my god, this is so crazy. I was like, what's another way I can like paint and make art? And then I was like, oh, I can do it with food, you know. And that was right when like everything with like TV chefs was like appearing, and every channel was trying to do a TV show. And that was like 2007 and into 2008. And then I went to school in 2008. My parents weren't very excited about that. They were not happy at all. They were hoping that I would become an engineer because I'm really good at like building things and numbers and fixing broken appliances.
That's a big skill in a kitchen.
Absolutely. It turned out pretty well. You know, I can fix a temper machine.
So you went to culinary school down in Florida?
Yeah, I went to Le Cordon Bleu. I wanted to go in Paris, and my mom was like, absolutely not. You're not leaving this house until you have a degree. I think she kind of noticed that I had flight syndrome. So as my mom, she tried to protect me as best as I could to keep me, you know, as safe as possible.
What is flight syndrome? I never heard of that.
It's like where you want to escape your reality. You get so overwhelmed with anxiety and you're depressed, and you figure, if I leave this situation that I'm in that's causing me all this grief, everything will become better. It took me a long time in New York to realize that that was a symptom of my anxiety and how I coped as a coping mechanism to make it better for me. But now I have a little bit more resources and tools. But it wasn't always that way, you know. I probably was not the best employee at a certain point in time.
So you're in Orlando and you decide you're going to go to culinary school.
Yeah, neither of my parents or my mom and my dad weren't really into it. But they've always been supportive of everything that I've ever done. They kind of like had a chat within like amongst themselves, and they were like, why wouldn't we support her now? They let me dig my own grave, basically, in a... At first, it seemed like I was just like, oh man, why did I do this? I could have just been an engineer, you know? But hard work pays off at the end of the day. It's not easy. The culinary industry isn't kind, but I've found kindness in it.
how was your culinary school experience?
It was fun. I liked it. And then anxiety kicked in. And then I was like, oh my God, Mom, I have to quit. And she's like, why? And I'm like, I don't know. I just have to quit. She was like, well, can you maybe accelerate the program? Still graduate, try to graduate. So I went into like the bursar's office and I was like, I need your help. I'm going through like this. I don't know what it is. I don't understand what it is, you know? And that was when like 2008 happened and we had like the economic depression. So all of the jobs were like disappearing. It wasn't easy to be a culinary student back then because you were looking at all your options. You were like, where am I even going to stage? Where am I even going to do my externship? So I asked the bursar's office, I was like, do you think it's possible for me to go to school all day and see if I can like graduate early so that I could maybe get more working experience and maybe get a job? And they were like, it's intense because I had already been going to school 5 days a week. We were there for like 8 hours. So I had started to go to school at 7 a.m. and then I wouldn't leave school until midnight.
Paola, that's really intense.
Yeah. But I feel like it kind of prepared me for the actual restaurant industry. I had a competitive advantage once I went to work because I knew exactly what it felt like to just be stuck in a place working really hard. So culinary school was cool, I guess. It wasn't like as aggressive now as I think back on it, you know, because you had time to like research and read and study and take tests. If I only knew back then, I would have prolonged it as long as possible.
So at what point did you head back to New York City?
Right when I had to do my externship in 2009. So I did a 2-year program in like 9 months and I graduated basically. So I went back to New York. I was like, I should go back to New York. So what you guys didn't know was my mom and my mother's cousin, they had restaurants in New York. They were like in St. Mark's and 91st Street. And other places. It was kind of scattered through New York as like Mexican Tex-Mex, you know, very popular in the 90s/early 2000s for their margaritas. And my mom was always working in the restaurants. I figured I was like, hey, if I go back to New York, maybe there's more restaurants because I knew of one, at least one restaurant that I could work at. But I didn't really work there. I worked at everywhere else. I worked at a French Vietnamese place. And I worked in a Dominican spot. I'm really good at peeling plantains now. I did so much, you know. I worked with Columbia Presbyterian, but it wasn't easy to be like in the culinary, like savory side of stuff because it didn't matter where I went to work. They always kind of like put me in the pastry side of stuff because they figured like, oh, well, maybe you're not good at cooking, but maybe you can at least make a panna cotta.
And they did this before they even knew what your skills were.
Right. I wasn't really aware. When you're that young in the industry, I always recommend to do as much as you possibly can so that you can learn what you're actually good at. Instead of assuming you're good at something, just learn. And you might be able to be one of the best sourdough bakeries in the future. But if you don't introduce yourself to making your own starter and baking sourdough or grilling or being a butcher, how will you know what you're actually going to be good at?
That's great advice. Can we go back to your mom for a second? I want to talk about your mom and her restaurant experience.
Oh, yeah. So I was almost born in my family's restaurant.
Literally?
Yeah. She was in the daytime, she was their accountant. So she was making sure that they balanced their books. My mom is super smart. She doesn't like talking about it, but she's like super smart with numbers. I never need a calculator when I'm around her. And she was making sure that like 9 restaurants were running properly and efficiently and above board, you know, because all of these folks, you know, like I grew up with them. They saw me almost born in these restaurants, you know, so these folks had worked with my family's company for years, you know, so she made sure that she was always taking care of them, you know, making sure that the financials were right. And she was pregnant with me and the office was in the basement in 91st and Broadway. and she went downstairs and her water broke and she almost couldn't come up the stairs. She was like, oh my God, you know? And I was like, I'm just out here just trying to be born and stuff. Hello guys, y'all hiring, you know?
Oh my gosh. So she got to the hospital in time.
They did. They got to the hospital in one of the biggest snowstorms in the 90s and I came out.
But that would have been a good story if you were actually born in a restaurant.
I know, but is that ethical? Like, is that above, like, is that up to code? Like, I don't know. You know, I feel like if I knew that story, I don't know. I'd be like, oh, why weren't you at home? You know?
So do you think, given that your mom knew the industry so well, was she encouraging of you or did she try to discourage you?
She absolutely tried to discourage me. She was like, please, because back then, right, in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, people that looked like me weren't chefs. They wouldn't have gotten that opportunity to run a restaurant or a bakery, let alone be hired for more than maybe a cook position at the lowest tier. I was talking to a friend, Chef Ozzy from Laundry, and she was telling me, like, in her experience in fine dining, you know, all you see in the back of the kitchen is black and brown cooks. And then the representation in the front is all, you know, non-Black Indigenous people of color. So, of course, my mom was scared. You know, she has me, who has melanin in her skin, an afro, a button nose, and she's scared. She's scared that the same industry that she knows is going to break me. And it almost did. Everything that I've experienced as a woman of color in the industry wasn't welcoming. It wasn't kind. It felt like I was fighting for my life every day.
But still, you constantly pushed forward. I don't get the sense that you ever let that deter you. Can you talk about your experience with Jacques Torres? And why did you decide you wanted to work for him? And how did you get your job?
It wasn't until 3 years later of working in New York kitchens, small restaurants, big restaurants, fine dining and not, that I was finally like, I need a change of life. Like, this is aggressive. I don't want to go home at 4 a.m. all the time to then come back at noon. And I was like, maybe it's different if you work in pastries. And I was like, okay, so let's look up the best pastry chefs in New York. You know, Mr. Chocolate came up and I was like, I've never worked with chocolate like that. I would like to learn. They had just moved to their Brooklyn Army Terminal location where they have their factory. I was living in Harlem at the time, so I went all the way to Bay Ridge. I forget names now that I'm living here in D.C., but I went to Bay Ridge and I just went to the factory and I was like, hi, you don't know me from Adam, but I would like to work here. And I had built up a good resume. I was sous chef. I was willing to leave it all behind. Like, I was just like, I don't really care how much you can pay me. I just want to work for you. I just want to learn. I'm open and willing, you know? And he was just like, I respect that. And he hired me. And then within 4 months, I became his pastry sous chef, the youngest in the company.
You just literally showed up on their doorstep.
Yeah. I feel like back then you didn't have like poached jobs or culinary agents to lead you to the water to drink. So you kind of had to do like, I don't want to say like grassroots. You have to be like pretty aggressive, you know? It's like finding an apartment in New York. Like, you have to be very aggressive to get it. And that's the same thing with jobs that you feel like are going to impact your career. It's not easily attainable. But the only thing that I was very moved by was that Jacques didn't ask me any other questions more than where did you go to school? And that was it. Like, he didn't ask me like my work experience. He let me start at zero, knowing that I had experience, but that I was willing to like not use it as a crutch to say I'm good or I'm good at this, or, you know, I was just like, very humble, like, you know more than me, so if you can teach me, I will work here, you know? And it was the first time ever in the industry where I was treated like a person. I wasn't yelled at. Like, I had weekends off. I would work 9 to 5 basically, and they promoted me. Like, they told me, they were like, hey, you know, you're learning about chocolate and you're creating all of these things at lightning speed. That's not normal, you know? Do you want to be a pastry sous? And I was like, is it anything different than what I have to do now? And they were like, no, absolutely not. But it's a title. So they kind of like rewarded me for my work. And that's the first time that I ever felt validated. Like Chef Hosty and I, at one point, we designed like a chocolate line of like shoes and purses. You know, I was able to like come up with like ice cream flavors. And there's a creativity to my job that I've never experienced before. Like I never had the opportunity to be creative. And then once they saw that, they didn't want to let it go. But life is kind of tricky like that. So I was like, in wanting to know more, I was like, I have to see how far I can push these limits. I asked to like work at different places. So I kind of like hopped around in New York, and I experienced a world that I had been shielded from for a year and a half. You know, a lot of people would hire me or like allow me to come into their kitchen, and they would say, do you think you're somebody because you work with Jacques Torres? And I'm like, no, I don't think I'm anything. I just want to learn, you know?
So they would literally try to tear you down before you'd even started the job.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Honestly, you know, and it was very dehumanizing. And I vowed that if I ever became a manager, I would never treat anybody like that again. I would never treat anybody how I was treated. You know, I would never let anybody come into an interview and look at them and rip their application in their face.
Do you think they were doing that because you were a woman of color, or do you think they were trying to exert dominance over anyone who walked in the door?
It could have been a mixture of both, right? I had a level of confidence after being told that you're good at something for a year and a half, and then knowing that they allowed you, that they let you go and explore more options. Of course, you feel kind of like, I'm ready to take on the world. And till this day, I still don't go into any place shy anymore, right? In the beginning of it, I was very shy, and Jacques and Hosty broke that in me. They were like, you need to own up to what you know, like this is different, you know, like your mind is a little different. And if we could replicate you and like have you everywhere, like we would want that, but we can't, you're just you, you know? So that kind of encouragement, like, built me up into the person that I am today, where I'm not cocky, right? Because if you're like overly like secure in yourself and you're like, my desserts are the best thing on planet Earth, sometimes they just stop being the best thing on planet Earth, you know? But I know that there's like confidence, you know, I'm very confident in me being able to make something as simple as bonbon, because they took, like, Jacques and Hosty were able to like positively reinforce me every day. But then going into the industry again, coming out of, you know, like the little safe haven that we had at the Brooklyn Army Terminal at Jacques Torres, I felt so defeated. That was when I finally realized that I had issues with my mental health, because I was broken. I had somebody treat me so badly and dehumanize me to the point where I lost control of who I was. And it was after therapy and after kind of like getting back into like a place of zen that I realized that I was like conditioned to think that I was less than. And then somebody told me I was a little, like, I was better, you know, and then somebody had to remind me and crush me. I never experienced something that intense in my life again. And I'm very careful with how I operate now. It changed my whole being, you know.
Paula, was that a work experience that did that to you?
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't even talking about mental health issues in the industry back then, and you were going through that. I mean, how did you find the help that you needed?
I found support in my friends in the Brooklyn Army Terminal. I made really lifelong friendships, and my then boyfriend, now husband, was able to like steady me. I think like if I didn't have that support system, I might have never returned to the industry ever again. And then my mom, of course, you know, my mom, she kind of like helped me go through the process. In the Latino community, it's not really easy to say you have mental health issues, because then that's a sign of weakness. But my mom was like, there's nothing wrong with not being yourself in that respect, right? Like if you need help, go get help, you know? And everybody kind of like surrounded me and like embraced me. And then I asked Jacques to come back. I was like, can I come back to work? And he was like, yes, absolutely. You know, it was like he had my job on hold, you know. And then I had to move to DC.
Because your husband had a job there.
Right. I had gone through everything. I had my spirit broken. And then I had gotten married and then returned back to the chocolate factory. And then a few months later, I had to upend my life again to come to DC, you know, which wasn't a bad choice, or it wasn't, you know, it was just the timing. You know, life is very precarious. While it can be serendipitous, it just, life is complicated.
I think it's remarkable you didn't give up on the industry. I mean, I know how talented you are, so it would have been terrible for this industry to lose you. But given what it had put you through.
I mean, I almost quit. I almost worked at the post office. I had a job and everything. I had it lined up. All I needed to do was accept. And I might have been getting a government pension and my life would have been a lot different, you know.
We're very lucky that you stuck with it. We're going to jump ahead a little bit. I mean, we're going to have you back on the show to talk more about your career. But I want to jump ahead to Kith and Kin.
Yeah.
Because it's a different kind of restaurant. Can you, for those who don't know what Kith and Kin is, can you tell us?
Yeah, so Kith and Kin is an Afro-Caribbean restaurant in the Wharf area in Washington, D.C. We try to take flavors from the African diaspora and represent them either in fusion or in its totality to just kind of give people an idea of how big the African diaspora actually is in the whole world. It's really like a movement or like a sonata of the slave trade, but the story being told via food.
And how did you and Kwame connect?
I had moved to DC, and DC is actually pretty small. So everybody thinks that DC is like a big city. It's not. Everybody knows each other. Everybody knows everybody who's working in the industry. If you're in DC, don't burn bridges. it's not really good because we all know each other. But Kwame kind of saw me at events and then reached out. He's like, hey, are you from the Bronx? And I was like, yes. And he's like, okay, keep in contact. So it didn't matter what events I was going to or what was happening. He was always a big support. And he would always make sure to reach out and say hi. And I had gone to my first pastry chef job where I finally took the big leap of faith. Instead of being somebody's assistant or somebody behind the scenes, which I was very comfortable in, I liked being a supporting role. But I figured I was I'm not getting any younger. I'm going to hit 30 in a few years. I should try to at least do this to see what happens. And then I can always just go back to doing what I'm normally doing in my supporting roles. And Iron Gate hired me and it was a whirlwind over there. Everybody was just really enamored with what I was able to create and the stories that I was able to tell, and then kind of the fusion that I created with my heritage and Greek and Italian cuisine. And Kwame was always going to eat desserts. I didn't know because I was always in the kitchen. I was very shy, you know. And finally he reached out and he was like, hey, I would love for you to join my team at Kith and Kin. I see what you're doing with these Afro-Caribbean flavors. That's what we do here. To come do it here. And I was like, oh, I guess this is the next logical step, you know, this makes sense. So I didn't know what I was expecting, but I just wanted to create desserts and keep creating. And the opportunity to be a pastry chef doesn't come often to women of color, because if people write about you, then they take your picture and then you're representing the company. And I've been told several times that I don't fit the look or I don't fit the theme of what they want as representation in restaurants. It's the sad reality. We all didn't speak about it because we were just so nervous to be seen as the whistleblower. And we were maybe we need to stay quiet so that we can get jobs. So a lot of us endured that for, we would work together and we'd be I just went to this interview and they looked at me and then they told me that the position was filled. And then the very next hour, they put up a new job ad looking for a pastry chef. We all are trying to navigate. It's still not easy, you know what I mean? And I wrote in the Washington City paper here on ways to, you know, promote from within, you know, and to stop this racial bias that you have when you're picking what you think is going to be your public figure for the restaurant. none of that matters if the food tastes good. So Kwame really kind of like brought me in, and then I wanted to be there to support him and everything that he was doing. And then if you remember anything about last year, it's that it was a crazy year for Chef Kwame. So I was just there making sure that the restaurant was following through with what his mission was and his vision. And people started learning about my desserts. I mean, I don't think that they're like these like over the top or like ornate. I just tell a story and I use my childhood flavors to guide you through my life's experience. One of my favorite desserts that I have on the menu is the plantain sticky buns. And that was inspired by my mom. She loves all things sweet plantains. And she actually eats them with brown sugar and cinnamon and roasts them. So I made that dessert because we were watching Guy Fieri, my mom's like favorite character on Food Network, and mine also too subsequently is Guy Fieri, you know? So I was like, oh my gosh, my mom loves this pecan sticky bun that he's enjoying on this show. And my mom loves sweet plantains. So I'm going to make this dish for her. It was actually pretty fun to make that dish because one thing that I do is when I'm making a dish, I include the whole kitchen, front of house, back of the house, sweet and savory, and they all get to give me like pointers and like they taste all of our food. So we work on a dessert for at least a whole month before it goes live. Sometimes it's the idea is like right there and I just make it, you know, and other times I want to see them like interacting with this dessert, tasting it, seeing how I change the salt levels and using, you know, coconut sugar as opposed to like light brown sugar. And it was just like a mini viral phenomenon inside of the kitchen. We were all tweeting about it. We were all like doing Instagram lives about it. We had I think it was like the launch date was like January or something like that, and like people were having like countdowns and they were like, oh my god, it's gonna plantain buns, you know. It was just so much joy.
Did it wind up that every single diner in the restaurant would order them for the table?
We would make over, I don't even know how many, like over how many, but every day we had to have them on account. I would have like at least 100 portions and they were all on account and they would all sell out. I guess it was like a cult favorite because people would be like, I'm here for the plantain buns. I'm like, why are you whispering? Why are you whispering? You know, like, why are you so like excited about this plantain bun? But you can taste my mom's joy regarding her love of Guy Fieri and plantains. You can taste it in the dish. And that's exactly what I do. I just take memories and sentiments and I put it on a dish, you know, and sometimes it's not beautiful. Sometimes it's like very straightforward and people just, they feel it. You can feel that like connection when you eat food like that.
Can you tell us about another dessert?
I have something called the chocolate chip thickum. And I called it that because I wanted to kind of take away that like negative connotation with the word thick and fat and juicy. Because usually when you look at a black or brown woman's body, you're told like, oh, she's too thick, or, you know, it's not the right proportions, or, you know, it's too, and you feel like you are an object on display. So I wanted to make like this big, can I curse? Never sure. Mind. Yeah, I wanted to make this big cookie to kind of like be powerful about it. Be like, this is a chocolate chip thickum, and I want you to say thickum over and over when you have to order this. And people were so uncomfortable. They're like, can I get the chocolate chip? And I'm like, say it. There's nothing wrong with being thick. There's nothing wrong with having curves. There's nothing wrong with who you are. There's nothing wrong with that word. So break that stereotype. And I feel like there's only one place on planet Earth that would have let me do something like that. So it was Kith and Kin. I had been working on that recipe since I was volunteering in Williamsburg, Brooklyn with a homeless shelter. I would use cookies like that to sell on the corner of Williamsburg to raise money for feminine products for the local girls that were going into that stage in their life.
Pella, you're remarkable. That is a good segue into Bakers Against Racism, because clearly philanthropy, standing up for people, standing up for yourself, trying to make a difference is something you've lived your whole life.
Yeah. I've been pretty quiet about it. Like I said before, I was very shy. Still am, I guess. I don't know. It seems weird because it seems like an oxymoron because I'm always in the public light now, but it's like pulling teeth actually to get me to do stuff like this.
Well, I didn't mention that you were a James Beard nominee for Rising Star. How did that feel then?
I don't know still. I don't know. I don't think about it often. I don't let it cloud my judgment. The things that are the most important to me are making sure that people are safe and people are happy and that I can create a good work environment and that people can find joy in their jobs when I couldn't find joy in my job before. So while I'm very honored and thank you, James Beard Foundation. But to me, like to talk to Deandra, my pastry sous chef, and hear her say, you know, the words "I love you" to me, you know, that's on similar levels of getting nominated for the James Beard.
It must have been, I mean, you can tell me how you felt, but I would imagine it was crushing to be nominated, to be working at this very different kind of restaurant, you know, run by Kwame, who has been very open about the discrimination he's faced in the past. He clearly wanted to create something different from what he had experienced. And then coronavirus strikes and the restaurant has to close. How did you handle that?
I think it was good for me. At Kith and Kin, we were running at 100 miles per hour supporting Chef Kwame. And then all of a sudden, I was running at 1,000 miles of hours per hour because I was supporting Chef Kwame. And then all of a sudden, all of these like accolades started amounting to me. It's a lot of pressure to keep up, you know, when people don't often see a woman of color, a Black woman from the Caribbean in these positions that are so esteemed and getting recognized from organizations and from foundations that are so highly regarded. There's so much pressure to make sure everything's right while making sure that your staff is good, like making sure that they're not being overworked or put in a situation that's not right because you want to keep up with the clout. So coronavirus stopped and we all had a moment to breathe and focus again on our mental health. And I'm closer to Nikki and Deandra and Ceci and Flora and Freddie, my core team, because I have time to talk to them more now. You know, we text, we call.
You did not use this time as a hiatus.
No. No, I felt like there was a lot of injustice regarding the immigrant community, the undocumented community in the restaurants. So I used my time and my resources. I donated my time 100%. And with Daniela Senora at Serenada, she's also Dominican, like me. And we were just raising funds for an organization here called Ayuda DC that helped undocumented immigrants get legal funding or get help for rent now that coronavirus was a very real and present thing. And their stimulus checks and their unemployment checks weren't coming in. So yeah, I used my time to give back to a portion of the community that I believe 100% is the sustaining pillar of the restaurant industry.
And tell us about your donut project.
Oh yeah, it's just donuts that have like my childhood flavors. There's not a lot of Dominican people in the DMV area, and that's like DC, Maryland, Virginia. So I wanted to give people a taste of home as we all were kind of like sheltering in place and unable to go to our families or go back home to the Dominican Republic. I wanted to give them those like familiar flavors in something that was very kind of like familiar in American cuisine, which is donuts. You know, it's a great vessel. You can't go wrong with a good donut.
Tell us about some of the flavors.
So we had the bizcocho dominicano, which was a pineapple and guava filled brioche donut with suspiro, which is Italian meringue, the Dominican cake. That is the country's national cake. If you go to any Dominican birthday party, that's what you would eat. And I made that into a donut. And then I had an old fashioned donut with a little bit of nutmeg and cinnamon and passion fruit and hibiscus glaze called Como la Flor to kind of give homage to Selena and how her representation on TV kind of empowered me to see a Latina woman on TV. And then I had another one. It's called Dulce de Leche. So that was an homage to Valrhona, actually. Because they were the only company that had ever reached out to me to kind of include me in the conversation as a chef. They would like reach out and make sure that they answered all of my questions, and they would, you know, let me try products or take me to events or whatever. And when you think about it, a lot of chefs, when you get to like a certain level, everybody's like trying to get a piece of them. And Valrhona was the only one that was like, we see you and we value you. So I did that Dulce de Leche for them, but it's a play on words because they have a toasted white chocolate that's called Dulce. And we have in Latinx culture something called dulce de leche, which is caramelized cream. And I turned that into a donut flavor, mimicking the dulce de leche with the dulce chocolate, using a little bit of malt vinegar and coconut as well.
I'm very sorry I don't live in the DC area to be able to try any of these. I think this is kind of a theme for a lot that you do, but this kind of became wildly popular also. And took off.
Yeah, I think it was just folks found themselves in these donuts. It didn't matter if you were Dominican or if you were just Latinx identifying. You found like home, you know, you could taste home in that. I had with Daniela and Andrew and AJ from Serenata, we had kind of like devised a plan to launch a successful pop-up while being socially distant. So I had made up the concept, made up the logo, and then like the plan on how to sustainably offer this food without having to like make more or less than what you need to make. So it makes a little bit of an impact in the environment. You only use what you need to use. People only come to the establishment for a reason. And then pickups were like a minute, 2 minutes each. If we said hi, maybe it was 4 minutes. So we kept people as safe as possible, you know, so it was something that we kind of prided ourselves in because it was just so effortless. There was no hiccups ever. And that's not easy to do when you're first launching a pop-up in the middle of a pandemic, which was how I kind of like segued into Bakers Against Racism. Chef Willa, she works at Emily's here in D.C., and she's their pastry chef, and I'm actually a big Willa fan. She didn't know that at the time because I'm very like private, and I like sneaking in and out of restaurants when I eat so that they don't have to spend more money and sending like complimentary stuff because that's how the industry is. But I don't want them to spend anything more than what I order because I want to support them. And Willa was really good at like mashing up flavors, and she had like this like coconut pandan pudding with like this like roasted banana and like coconut chips. It was just great. Willa reached out to me and she was like, hey, you know, I see everything that's going on in the news with the protests and Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, and the death of George Floyd. You know, it breaks my heart. I saw that you were hosting a really successful pop-up for Doña Donut benefiting Ayuda DC. Would you be interested in doing something similar with me for the Minnesota Freedom Fund? And I was like, Willa, give me a day to think about it, you know? And she was probably mortified. She was probably like, oh my God, I, you know, in trying to do a good thing, I kind of like maybe asked her to do too much, you know, I wasn't being, and she like messaged me on Monday and she was like, I'm so sorry, you know, you don't actually have to do this with me. We don't have to bake anything. I'm sorry if I like took up your time. And I was like, oh no, Willa, what's your email? And I had formatted everything that we have done at Doña Donut into an accessible document. And I made a mission statement. And I was like, if we're all going to bake, you and I at most can maybe raise like $3,000, $4,000, which isn't a small amount of money. But imagine if we got more bakers to come and join us. And I had put that into writing. I had given like guidelines and kind of like a mode of operations to host a successful pop-up. But it was a virtual bake sale that was decentralized, open to all. Because I saw all the Instagram posts. I saw the hashtags. I saw you guys baking, you know, your sourdoughs and banana bread. And I was like, you can sell that and raise funds for organizations that are localized to you that are going to impact Black lives. And I had reached out to Rob, Chef Rob here in DC. He owns Oyster, that's about to open. And I was like, hey, Rob, I love your graphics all the time. And I know you make them yourself. Can you help me? He's like, sure. what do you need from me? And I was like, I need you to make a logo that says Bakers Against Racism. You have all creative freedom. And he's like, what? You know? And I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry. I put this on your plate, but please, please. And it just took off from there. You know, that was on, Willow reached out to me on the 30th. That was my last pop-up day. And I was so tired. And I had only raised like $1,100 for Ayuda. And then like Rob made the graphics on Sunday. I compiled everything into a Google folder. I emailed Willow on Monday. I had talked to Maru from Serenata. She does our PR. And I was like, you can talk to them locally and maybe some people want to join locally. And I was telling Willa, I was explaining to Willa, I was like, hey, we only need 80 participants to join this in order for it to be like impactful. And she's like, what do you mean? And I was like, if we all bake 150 desserts at $8, all we need is 80 people and we would raise $96,000. And she's like, whoa, my God. And you know, I could hear Willa's brain going like, phew. And we were so excited. We were like, oh my God, $96,000. Luckily, my husband is like very like good at logistics and stuff. And he was just like, do not accept any of the money yourself. Make people donate directly to the organizations and it'll be less hassle for you. And I was like, yes, that sounds like a very wise idea.
So you were hoping you would get about 80 folks participating.
Mm-hmm.
What happened instead?
Oh my goodness. So we launched on Thursday night. I had secured a hashtag and an Instagram and a Twitter, and I made a Google email. It cost $0 to make this. Like literally, it cost us $0 to start this initiative. And I launched it and I just was like, hey, bakers. Because I feel like if I explain how I talk, people are going to be like, oh no, it's so awkward. Oh, you know, but I was like, hey, bakers, do you hate racism? And I was just like, this is how you can join us, use these hashtags, but donate and learn about the organizations that are actually impacting Black communities and enriching these communities and protecting these communities. With Bakers Against Racism, I really wanted people to get into, instead of it being a hashtag where you say Black Lives Matter and then you move on, you're baking, you're doing something that's so personal. My grandmother taught me how personal it is to cook for somebody. To cook for somebody and feed them is wanting them to live. So in Bakers Against Racism, I was making a call to action for people to want Black lives to live. And that's why we say Black Lives Matter. So now we're on 5 continents, 17 countries, and over 41 states, over 200 plus cities. We have Bakers Against Racism, Berlin, Paris, London, Australia, Richmond. We have the Cast Iron Collective in Los Angeles, Seattle. We have Toronto, New York. Did I say Philly already? I'm getting confused. Miami, Texas, Minneapolis. It's something that, like I said, it costs $0 to make. I just gave people my resources, something that I learned during COVID, and gave them the opportunity to join. And people were willing. The same sentiment that Willa had in her heart, we were able to turn it into this huge worldwide event.
You've had such an interesting journey, Paola, and faced so much discrimination in the industry. Does this give you hope for what comes next?
I think it opens up the door. Bakers Against Racism is the first step in creating lasting change in Black communities, especially within the restaurant industry. While I'm so excited that people are participating, I want to see what you guys do after Bakers Against Racism. I want to see how you hire from within. I want to see how you educate and empower people of color to become leaders in the culinary industry. I want you to really care about Black lives. It's not just a one-time thing. It's not just we'll revisit it in the future. This is our life that we're asking you to care about. So after Bakers Against Racism ends, I hope that people keep the same energy and the same momentum to keep moving forward for change.
Well, you've planted an incredible seed. And knowing you, I'm sure there's going to be a part two to this where you can kind of track what's going on. But I'm not even going to ask you about that yet because I want you to be able to enjoy this moment. And you're also participating.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a lot now. I actually am doing a passion fruit strawberry buckle cake. kind of to play a little bit of homage to the South, but still keeping my heritage, and then kind of highlight the season that we're in. And then Deandra, my pastry sous chef, is making a piña colada cake, which sounds very tropical, but is very Southern. And it's her mom's favorite dessert. So it's an homage to the Black woman. And Nikki, she is my head baker from the Philippines. And she is making her famous banana bread. It's like a local staple here. We all love it. So everybody's pretty excited. I've already sold out. We've all sold out.
How much do you think you'll potentially raise?
So much. We're tracking it right now. We have our donation tracker and the number just keeps jumping and I just keep getting lightheaded and I'm like, this is intense, you know? I thought it was intense when I saw the number of bakers, but the generosity in people's hearts right now, especially for so many different organizations, you know, we have the Oka Project and Black Mamas and we have the Innocence Project, and people are really researching what these organizations are doing. Organizations that have been here for 10, 15, 20 years, you know, they're now just finally aware of them. And people are giving. People are giving wholeheartedly. And that's beautiful, you know, like I don't have to will you to give. I'm not coercing you. I'm not forcing you, you know, you out of the abundance of what you're feeling in your heart, you're taking not only your time and your talents, but your resources. And then the people who are buying their donation and buying and trusting that we're going to just make an impact that's bigger than ourselves, you know?
Absolutely. Well, Paola, I've loved talking to you and I can't wait till you come back on the show. Once you've had a bit of a break personally and professionally, you just have so much wisdom to share. I have to ask you one last question. I know you're still young, but I would like to know what your advice is to young or aspiring pastry chefs.
Don't give up. This industry is very difficult. We have to stand and exert a lot of physical energy and also mental energy. Don't let the burden of being successful distract you from the joy of creating and expressing yourself through food. I would just take it one day at a time. My biggest thing after kind of realizing that I was going through all of my struggles was that I reset. Every day is a new day. And everything that happened yesterday is not going to hold back my today.
That's beautiful. Paola, you're really the bomb. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Paola Velez for inspiring all of us. If you'd like to follow what Paola is up to, you can find her on Instagram at Small Orchids. Bakers Against Racism is on Instagram as well. If you want to see who is participating in their bake sale, check out the Bakers Against Racism hashtag. Thank you to Paola and her co-founders for their tireless work in the past 2 weeks. And thank you to all the Bomb Squad bakers who are participating. Radio Cherry Bomb is edited by Kat Garelli. Our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Tra-La-La. Hang in there, everybody, and thank you for listening. You are the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.
Hi, my name is Oria Abraham, and I'm the founder of Oria's Malaysian Kitchen. Do you want to know who I think is the bomb? Chef Eris Johnson, a professional private chef based in Brooklyn. She's got a long list of professional accomplishments, but what I'm most impressed with is the work that she does as an adjunct instructor at the Johannesburg Culinary and Pastry School in South Africa. She travels there annually and does the important work of inspiring young chefs to reach for their dreams. She's a gift to humankind and to the hospitality industry, and she's the bomb.